Last Sabbath, we resumed a series that I had begun some time ago on the origins of the political crisis in the Middle East. Every time you turn the news on, you maybe kind of look sideways and flinch a little bit, wondering what's going to be happening in the Middle East today. It always seems like something is going on. As far as I know today, it's, I guess, as calm as it ever will be. But we know that the entire region is always on edge. It's like a can of gasoline sitting next to a bonfire. Just the slightest spark can have explosive and disastrous results. With that in mind, let's turn to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew, the 24th chapter. Look at a couple of familiar statements here that Jesus makes in this key prophecy. Matthew chapter 24. Early in the chapter, he's been describing the events that will take place that will lead up to the time of the end of the age. And there's a parallel between these events and the seals that are listed in Revelation. Revelation 6, you can see that Jesus was talking about the same thing here as was revealed to the Apostle John. But I want to drop down to verse 15 after that general description. Based on that, Jesus says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Find a number of things here. First of all, there's something that's called the abomination of desolation. This will be the spark that ignites the Middle East. When that appears, then those who are in Judea need to flee for safety. I skipped over the parenthetical thought that's there at the end of verse 15, but it's an important part of this verse. It says, "Whoever reads, let him understand." That would indicate that there are many who will not understand. And it's important that those who do understand recognize what is happening. And I'll emphasize again that this takes place in Jerusalem. This is in the Middle East. And that's one reason why we consider that region is extremely important for us to be aware of, to consider, and for us to keep in mind, because an event will take place there that will change everything. Verse 21 says that then, that is when this abomination of desolation appears, then there will be great tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. Now, between now and the time that this event takes place, there are likely to be more disruptive events in the Middle East. There'll be more things happening, more sparks flying, more explosions and disasters occurring. But this is the event, the key event that Jesus is warning about, which will take place at the holy place in Jerusalem. Now, we want to talk more about that event, what it will be, how it will affect the Middle East, how it will affect the rest of the world, how it will affect God's people. But to get to that future event and to understand it and to be able to recognize it when it begins, when it does come about, we begin with the past. I've stated many times that prophecy is important, but you really can't understand prophecy unless you have a handle on history. Because much of prophecy is based on what has happened, either as a matter of a duality or at least to setting the perspective and the foundation for what will take place. So we want to continue today with our review of that history. Why is there so much tension in that part of the world? How did things get to be the way they are? To gain some perspective, we've gone back to the beginning and we'll pick up the story again today. Now, first of all, I recognize this is really basic history, and that most of you are probably well aware of the things we'll be talking about this afternoon. But I think it's good to review them, especially as we move toward the fall holy days, and we're more tuned in to prophecy. We're looking ahead to events that will happen. We're anticipating those events that will lead up to the time of the return of Jesus Christ. The stage for those events has already been set, and it's a matter of those things that need to happen to begin to unfold. And it helps us to see that happen as we, again, have a good handle on history. So bear with me if you must, but let's review again some of these events that lead us to that critical time. First of all, a quick review of what we talked about last week. We saw in Genesis 12 that God began to work with Abram when Abram was 75 years of age. Abram and his wife Sarah, when they moved into Canaan at God's direction, had no children, yet God had promised Abram that he would have descendants that would become a great nation, and ultimately all of mankind would be blessed through his descendants. Abraham trusted God, he believed him, but after 10 years had passed, they still had no children. Abram and Sarai decided that perhaps Abram could have children and descendants by another wife. Maybe that would be how God would provide that his descendants. So Sarai gave to Abram her Egyptian servant Hagar, and sure enough, by her, Abram had a son named Ishmael. But we see in Genesis 17 that 13 years after Ishmael was born, God again appeared to Abram and confirmed that Abram would miraculously have a son by Sarai, not by someone else. And that son would be his heir. It was at that time that God also confirmed his covenant with them, and he changed their names to Abraham and Sarah. Abraham pleaded that God would accept Ishmael as the one who would receive the inheritance. God told him no, it would be Isaac, but Ishmael would also become a very populous nation. The inheritance, though, and the promises would go to his son Isaac. When Isaac was about 3 years of age, Ishmael, who by then would have been 16, and his mother were sent away from Abraham's household. Years later, Ishmael took an Egyptian wife, and over a period of time had 12 sons. And we're told in Genesis 25, verse 18, that they settled east of Egypt, which would put them in the northern Arabian desert. Meanwhile, Abraham's son Isaac married into his mother's side of the family. His wife was Rebekah, who was the daughter of Abraham's nephew. You figure it out. First cousin, twice, second removed, whatever it would be. He married a fairly close relative. But the point is that he did not marry a Canaanite, and he did not marry someone from Ishmael's or Esau's side of the family. Now we know that Isaac and Rebekah had twin sons. Esau and Jacob had a contentious relationship even from before the time that they were born. They wrestled with each other in the womb, so much so that Rebekah was worried about her pregnancy. God revealed to her that she would be giving birth to boys who would become two nations. The firstborn was Esau, who later became known as Edom, which means red, because he sold his birthright to his brother Jacob for a bowl of red lentil soup. Jacob, and for that matter his mother, were connivers, and they tricked Isaac, when he was elderly and blind, into passing the blessing on to Jacob rather than his intent, which was to give the blessing to Esau. So we see already that Abraham has two distinct family lines, Ishmael and Jacob. Now Esau was part of the family line along with Jacob. However, Esau was excluded from the birthright and the blessing, the special promises of the blessing. So the family line followed through Jacob. Esau, of course, felt cheated and he hated his brother. And he decided that when their father died, he would kill Jacob. That's where we left off last time in Genesis chapter 27, verse 41. The title of the sermon this afternoon is The Peoples of the Middle East. We want to see what their origin is, what relationship or connection they have, and how it is that there is such contention in that region. To get to this background about the peoples of the Middle East, we'll backtrack a bit. Go back to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis, the 10th chapter. This, as we mentioned before, is the Table of Nations. It lists the at least a brief genealogy of the three sons of Noah. Verse 15 is part of the genealogy of Ham. Ham has a son named Canaan. And then it lists here in this verse the sons that Canaan and all the tribes that came through him, all these ites. These are all tribes who descended from their forefather, Canaan. Afterwards, it says at the end of verse 18, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. Where they dispersed to, we're told in verse 19, is into the region that we now know as Canaan. Now, their ancestor was named Canaan, they were Canaanites, and so what do you name the area you move into? Well, of course, you name it Canaan. And this is the area now that we associate with Israel, later with Israel and Judah, and the part of the Middle East now where the nation of Israel is located. But these are all the Canaanite tribes that moved into that area. These are their families according to their languages and their lands and their nations, it says in verse 20. So we have at least a general idea of where these people settled. And they became these little tribes, kind of like an extended family. And we'll see later that there was a lot of rivalry and contention even among and between them. They were dispersed into this region. Remember that after the flood, which exactly, as far as we know, the year the flood ended was 2325 B.C. 2325 B.C. was when the ark settled on Mount Ararat, which we understand to be in the northeastern part of what is today Turkey. So it's several hundred miles north and east of where the land of Canaan eventually came to be. But these tribes, these families, were dispersed and they went into that region. Now, these are the Canaanite tribes that inhabited the area where Abraham was settling. Besides the Canaanites, there were direct descendants of Abraham who populated the area. We're going to talk about four groups of family, of the family line that is part of Abraham's descendants. All of these are separate from Isaac, but four family groupings of Abraham's descendants who populated this Middle Eastern area we're talking about. The first of these we'll talk about are the descendants of Lot. Won't go through the whole story, but you can pick it up in chapter 13, where we're told that Lot moved into Canaan with Abram. And as Abram moved there and with his family, or his wife and his possessions, Lot traveled with him. tells us, I guess, a little bit about a relationship between Lot and Abram. There were still other family members who remained in Haran that Lot could have stayed with, but he came to Canaan, or to this area, to Canaan with Abram. So there was a relationship there. I don't know if he was like a mentor to him, or maybe a substitute father. Lot's father and grandfather had both died, and so he became somewhat attached to Abram. Now, Lot was also a wealthy person. It says in verse 5 and 6 that he had flocks and herds and tents, and there was so much that he had combined with so much that Abram had, that it was difficult for them to live together, especially their shepherds. Just did not get along with one another. And so to keep some degree of peace, Lot separated from Abram, as you see in verse 12 here in chapter 13. Just a note to pick up from verse 7. It talks about the strife between the various herdsmen. But notice at the end of the verse, it says that the Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. So Perizzites were apparently another tribe of the Canaanites. Not much is said about them specifically, but they kind of lumped in and grouped with the Canaanites. So in other words, Abraham and Lot were living among these Canaanite tribes. But they really posed no threat. They just were a family, and they were grazing their sheep, and so they were able to live peacefully in and among the Canaanites. But when they separated, Lot and his family went to Sodom. And it turns out they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. You look in chapter 14, you'll see that there was a war between the various tribes of the Canaanites. And Lot just kind of got stuck in the middle. Verse 12, verse 11, those kings that attacked took all the goods from Sodom and Gomorrah, the cities where Sodom was located, and all their provisions, and they went on their way. They also took Lot, Abram's brother, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. So Abram learned that his nephew had been captured and caught up in kind of a peripheral damage to this war, and Abram came to the rescue and was able to bring Lot and his goods and his family back home again. Interestingly enough, Lot went right back to Sodom. That was his home. That's where he wanted to be. We'll move ahead to chapter 19. This is the chapter where the angels come, and they're going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because they're such perverted cities. But notice it says they came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. Lot was sitting at the gate. Probably most of you at one time or another have been to a McDonald's restaurant early in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning. I think this is some kind of a rule they have in their corporate charter, but you'll find that any McDonald's on any weekday morning, there's always going to be a table of retired men sitting in the corner drinking coffee. That's their social club. That's where they hang out. And they sell coffee real cheap to seniors, and so I'm sometimes on my way someplace, and I'll stop to grab a cup of coffee. I see them in every one. They all look the same to me too. I'm not sure how that works out. But that's not what's happening here. Lot was sitting at the gate of the city. To sit at the gate of the city implies or represents the fact that Lot was among the city leadership. Those who were the city civic leaders would gather at the front gate of the city to make decisions relating to the community. Maybe there was some property issue to deal with, or something that was going on between a couple of the residents or citizens, but the leaders of the city would meet there. So Lot had actually risen to the level of being one of the trusted leaders in the city of Sodom. When you read the story here in Genesis, you kind of wonder what kind of man Lot might have been. But when you read what Peter said about him in 2 Peter, you find that Peter describes him as a righteous man. Of course, he was living in a very perverted city. But here he was among the leadership, and he welcomed these visitors and took them to his home to keep them safe and to provide for them. But they were there to rescue Lot, and eventually they did that. They rescued Lot and his wife and his two daughters. We know that his wife died on the trip out of Sodom. It says that she turned and looked back, which seems to imply that she didn't just glance to see what was happening. She longed for and would rather have been in Sodom and may have been a bit upset or even angry at what was happening to the city that she loved. God turned her into a pillar of salt. Kind of a mysterious thing. We don't know of any other cases where that happened. Don't know exactly what occurred. But she was no longer there. She was now, she'd been removed by God in this supernatural way. So now it's Lot and his two daughters. His daughters were concerned about what was going to happen to them. They'd left behind their city, their community, their friends, their connections, and now they were just out here in the wilderness with their father. So they came up with a really odd plan. To preserve the family line, they each would become pregnant by their father, which they did. Verse 36, both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. And here's the point we're getting to. The firstborn bore a son and called him Moab. He's the father of the Moabites to this day. And the younger also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi, and he is the father of the people of Ammon to this day. So here we find now the origin of some more people who populate the Middle East, the Moabites and the Ammonites. And as we look through and review today and in, maybe other times in the future as well, we'll see that the Moabites and the Ammonites were among the perennial enemies of the descendants of Isaac. This is their origin. We also find, now moving on to another group, we see now that the descendants of Moab and Ammon are going to be in this area. We also find in chapter 25 another part of Abraham's family that we really know very little about as well. Chapter 25, it mentions in the end of chapter 24 that his wife Sarah had died, and at that time Isaac married Rebekah. Chapter 25, then Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah. We don't know anything about Keturah. Nothing is said of her. But apparently she was a Canaanite. There's no indication that Abraham went to any effort to find a wife from his wife's family. But he apparently took a Canaanite wife, and by her he had six more sons. They're listed here at the beginning of chapter 25. Now, Abraham was faithful to God in his, as far as the inheritance and working with Isaac is concerned. Verse 5, Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. But Abraham gave gifts to the sons of the concubines which Abraham had. And while he was still living, he sent them eastward, away from Isaac his son, to the country to the east. To the east of what is now Canaan would be toward Babylon, toward and across the desert and toward Babylon. As the young men came of age, he gave them some resources, gave them some animals from his flock. He gave them a Canaanite servant or wife to go with them, and he sent them away. He preserved in this way the inheritance for Isaac and sent those sons out into the wilderness in the direction of Babylon, And from that point, we really don't know much about them, but they did populate that part of the Middle East. Now, I've already mentioned, so we have two groups now, the descendants of Lot and the descendants of the sons of Keturah. We also remember that there was the family of Ishmael. Ishmael and his descendants were also beginning to populate this same area. Chapter 25, verse 12, we find a list of the sons that were descendants of Ishmael. Jacob, remember, Isaac's son had 12 sons. So did Ishmael. Ishmael had 12 sons, 12 princes, they're called here. And we saw in chapter 16, verse 9, where Ishmael's birth was prophesied. Hagar was told that I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so they shall not be counted for multitude. So these 12 were sent out again into the desert, and they became a very populous nation themselves. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia has this to say in its article about Ishmael. It says, the character of Ishmael and his descendants, who were Arabian nomads or Bedouins, is very accurately and vividly depicted by the prophecy. He shall be a wild ass among men, his hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. That's quoting from Genesis 16:12. These nomads, the article concludes, are indeed roaming the wilds of the desert, jealous of their independence, quarrelsome and adventurous. This was the kind of people that Hagar was told that her son would be the ancestor of. As you see that prophecy in Genesis 16, verse 9, and also chapter 25. So there's a fourth, or a third group, I should say, of descendants of Abraham. You got the descendants of Lot, the sons of Keturah, the family of Ishmael, and of course, there's the family of Esau, another group of who are descended from Abraham, who populate this area in the Middle East. Genesis 36 gives a summary of the genealogy of Esau. Genesis chapter 36. Again, as these genealogies tend to do, it lists a whole lot of names that would injure our tongue to try to read. So I won't attempt to read through the list of his sons. But it says in verse 2 that he had taken wives from the daughters of Canaan. We know that he also married a daughter of Ishmael, his uncle. So these were the people that Esau married into, and they became his family. He did not choose or marry into his mother's family, but he went in the direction of his uncle, Ishmael. Just a couple of things to note here in this genealogy. Verse 6 says that Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the persons of his household, his cattle, all of his animals and his goods, which he had gained in the land of Canaan, and he went to a country away from the presence of his brother Jacob. He had certain wealth that he had accumulated while he was in Canaan. But as was prophesied, he moved away from, out of Canaan. Canaan was left to be where Jacob would live, and Esau dwelt in Mount Seir, it says in verse 8. Mount Seir is a very rugged wilderness area south of the nation of, south and a little bit east of the nation of what became Israel, or Judah. So, he moved away from. And remember that both Esau and Ishmael were told that they would live on the fringes of the blessings that were given to to Isaac and his descendants, and that they would not have the same level of blessing and comfort that would be given to the descendants of Isaac, or the descendants of Abraham through Isaac. Also notice in verse 12, I'm sorry, verse 16. Oh, okay. He was right in the first place. Verse 12. Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, who was Esau's son. And so Esau's son, through Timnah, has a son named Amalek. Amalek is the ancestor of the Amalekites. And the Amalekites, again, were a particular perennial enemy and thorn in the side of the people of the descendants of Isaac. And so we have then these groups of families who are all direct descendants of Abraham, but are not the family of promise. They were his descendants, but they dispersed throughout the Middle East, and they began to populate that region. There were four lines of Abraham's family: descendants of Lot, descendants of Ishmael, descendants of Esau, and the descendants of Keturah's sons. These mixed in with the Canaanite tribes, which we saw earlier, that filled the land of Canaan. They also then spread out into the Arabian Peninsula, northern Africa, and the Persian Gulf region. All throughout that region of the world are these descendants from Abraham's families and the Canaanites. These then became what we call the Arab peoples. According to the Encyclopedia Britannica, the term Arab refers to, quote, any of the inhabitants of the Arabic-speaking peoples in the vast region from the Atlantic coast of Africa to southwestern Iran, including Egypt, Sudan, the Arabian Peninsula, Syria, and Iraq. So that whole area, we call it the Persian Gulf or the Middle East, those nations are all populated by Arab peoples who are descendants of Abraham, and mixed in with them are the Canaanite tribes as well. Now, the covenant promises that were made to Abraham, he was told, would be fulfilled through Isaac. With all these other people filling that part of the world, God kept Isaac separate from them. God had chosen Isaac and his descendants to receive the covenant blessings and promises that came through Abraham. So you have Isaac then as another family or a line of Abraham that is now in this region. So now as we look at this again in kind of an overview, we see that the major players in the Middle East are established. Those people who will populate the Middle East are now in the region, and they are growing, and they are becoming tribes and then nations that fill this region. And now God is going to begin to weave his plan together through these people. If you read a good novel, and I'm not sure if the words good and novel belong in the same sentence, but if you read a good novel, you'll note that the author will usually construct a plot line by having several different stories that are occurring at the same time, that are occurring concurrently. And then as the story continues, he begins to weave those plot lines together into some dramatic and exciting conclusion. Well, that's a little bit like what we see in Old Testament history. We have all these people that God has brought together or put in place, that had begun to inhabit the land that he's promised to give to Abraham. But these people got there first. They've become vast nations and empires, and they're developing seemingly kind of independently of each other, but it's not random. It's part of what God is going to work with to fulfill his plan for his people. Genesis 28, we read through the end of chapter 27. From Genesis 28 through the end of the book of Genesis, you see that God is laying the foundation for his nation. It begins when Jacob flees to his family, and we see that the family line of Abraham now is what is being what we read of in this portion of the book. We're not going to read the whole section, of course, but you know the story. And it's easy to follow. It's like reading a good novel. To read from chapter 28 on through the end of the book of Genesis. Jacob flees from Esau to Haran, where his mother's family still lives. He marries Leah and Rachel, and by his two wives and two concubines, which were essentially wives as well, he has 12 sons. And he lived here for 20 years, working for and with Laban. But Laban was Jacob's match. Laban was a lot like Jacob. He was a manipulator, he was a conniver, he was a liar, and he cheated Jacob at every turn. And finally, Jacob had enough of it, and he took his family and he left to go back to Canaan. But a very significant event occurred along the way. As he was returning, God changed Jacob's name. Chapter 32. We know that names are significant, especially when God assigns them. And so this is a significant change to his name. Chapter 32, and verse 22, Jacob remained alone overnight. He wrestled with a man who turned out, of course, to be the human form of the Word. Jacob said, "I won't let you go unless you bless me." Verse 28 is what we want to get to. This is what he was told. "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." The name Jacob, of course, we talked about last week, means a supplanter, or a deceitful person, a manipulator, one who is not entirely honest. The Hebrew literally means one who takes the heel. And that's what happened in the womb. Jacob grabbed a hold of Esau's heel as he was wrestling with him for dominance, even before birth. That was Jacob's nature. And it certainly played out in the way that he acquired both the birthright and the blessing. But when Jacob is on his way back now to Canaan, he encounters and he deals directly with God, and he wrestles with him. It's kind of a mysterious thing, but the point is that Jacob was seeking a blessing and assurance from the one he recognized was someone special. It wasn't just another person he was wrestling. He recognized that this was one who could grant him a blessing. As I mentioned, Jacob had kind of met his match when he got paired up with Laban, and he'd learned what it's like to be treated the way he had been treating others. This, some have speculated, is kind of the conversion time of Jacob. And now, with that experience, what he's learned from, he returns, and God changes his name. The word, or the name Israel, means God prevails. Jacob learned to look to God in order to succeed rather than to manipulate and to do things on his own. It emphasized the life lesson that Jacob had learned through his experiences, to look to God rather than to try to do things on his own. So Jacob is now Israel. Israel is the father of 12 sons, the 12 sons of Israel. The 12 sons of Israel became the 12 tribes of Israel. And the 12 tribes ultimately become the nation of Israel. Now, throughout the Bible, you still see him referred to as Jacob, but the name that God assigned to him at this point is Israel, and that's the name that sticks with especially the peoples, the descendants who of Abraham through his grandson Jacob. Now, we know that God was working circumstances, and he brought Israel's son Joseph into slavery in Egypt. And Joseph eventually became the second highest official in the nation. He was guiding Egypt through a devastating 7-year drought. God brought these events together so that he could move Israel and the rest of his family into Egypt, where they would be preserved and protected during the drought. Interesting contrast here. The family through which God will work his plan is a tiny group of about 70 people when Israel or Jacob moves into Egypt. Egypt, on the other hand, is made up of the people who are descended from Ham, and Egypt has become a vast, powerful, dominating empire with hundreds of years of history and culture. These people came long before the ones that God would choose to be his nation. But God put them in place for the role they would have in preparing his people to become a nation. God had prepared an environment where this tiny group of 70 would become the nation of Israel. So at first, the family of Israel lived in a safe and abundant circumstance. The Pharaoh that in Joseph's time was very supportive of Joseph and of his family and made sure they had a very special place in the land where they could practice their way of life and be safe and secure. But over time, things changed. Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. There arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Let's deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and they join our enemies." So things shifted, things changed. And what had been a safe haven for the descendants of Israel became bondage. They were trapped in Egypt. They were slaves to the world's most powerful nation. So you know the story, the first 12 chapters in Exodus, how God miraculously rescued his people from slavery and brought them out of that land. But where would they go? Where would these people go? Nations tend to be families that grow large and expand in the land where they're living. But Israel was a nation without a place. There were at least 2 million population of the children of Israel at this point. Some commentaries estimate they were closer to 3 million. Where are these people going to go? Well, we know exactly what God was going to do. Exodus chapter 6. Exodus chapter 6. God spoke to Moses, verse 2. God spoke to Moses and said to him, "I am the Lord, I'm Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, but not by my name Yahweh." Now, actually, the word Yahweh does appear as a name of God earlier in the book of Genesis, but God was not yet fulfilling his role as the covenant God, which is what Yahweh means. So now he was going to begin to deal with the people of Israel to fulfill the covenant that he had made with Abraham. Verse 4, I have also established my covenant with them. So he's transferred the covenant he made with Abraham to these people of Israel to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage in which they were strangers. Now, the pilgrims and the strangers were Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and now their descendants, to whom the promised covenant has been transferred, will now be given that land that he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So the place there to go is the land that God originally had promised to give to the descendants of Abraham. Sounds pretty easy, sounds pretty simple. They just move in and take the land that God had intended for them to have. But of course, we know it didn't work out that easily, did it? The journey, the transition to the land was not an easy one. In fact, we know that at first, after about 18 months, they came to the land that God had offered to them, and they refused to go in because they were afraid of the people that were already there. They were afraid of the people who were already there. Remember, the flood ended in year 2325, and the children of Noah began to expand and to move out from where they were in northeast Turkey. Don't know how long it took for them to get down to Canaan, but eventually they did. Their families grew, and they migrated, and they wound up in the land of Canaan. If the flood was in 2325, and Israel is ready to move into Canaan, it's 1403 B.C., when Israel is at the gates and ready to move in to Canaan. 900-plus years have passed. The people of Canaan are deeply entrenched. This is their land. This is their culture. This is their territory. It's where they live. And for hundreds of years, that had been the case. Now here along comes this migrant people stumbling through the wilderness. This is from the perspective of the Canaanites. And they're going to take over our land. Not without a fight. The people of Canaan had to be displaced, had to be removed. But you know, there was trouble for Israel even before they got to Canaan. And it came from these other groups of people who were descended from Abraham and had moved into the area. They were fighting against the people of promise, the descendants of Abraham, from the very beginning. Look at Exodus chapter 17. Exodus chapter 17. Now, if you look at the chapters before and after this, this event takes place probably maybe 6 or so weeks after they've left Egypt. They're just getting started. They arrived at Mount Sinai, chapter 19. It says after 2 months. In the third month, they arrived in Mount Sinai. That probably was the days approaching Pentecost, what we call Pentecost. So it's only been a few weeks since they left. Verse 8 says, Amalek came forth and fought with Israel and Rephidim. Here's a tribe of people who were descended from Esau, living out in this wilderness region. And as the people of Israel are coming through, they are there to fight with them and to try to prevail against them. Now, this is the famous battle where Joshua holds up Moses' arms, and as long as his arms are up, then, of course, the Israelites are winning. Ultimately, they won the battle. But my point is, they just barely got out of Egypt, and they're already at war with one of the groups who are descendants related to them through Esau. So that happened almost immediately. Now let's skip ahead to the end of Israel's time in the wilderness. Turn to Numbers chapter 20. See, what we're seeing is, what we're trying to get a perspective on is why all the hatred and the turmoil in the Middle East today? The answer is, and we already know this answer, but the answer is that it goes way back to the very beginning. There's always been a hatred among the other peoples of the Middle East toward the people of promise, those descendants of Abraham, through whom God is fulfilling the covenant he made with him. Numbers 20. We're going to pick up a couple of highlights here. There's many others that we could look at. But notice chapter verse 14. This is at the end of their journey. They're approaching from the south up through the desert. They're going to come in a little bit to the north and then cut across at, at Jericho, about central part of what becomes Israel. But look at this. Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. Edom, Esau's descendants. Thus says your brother Israel. Here's the message from Moses to the people of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel. The people of Edom knew who Israel was. They know the family connection. They know the history. And they know the resentment between Jacob and Esau. Your brother is here. You know what's happened to us, all the tough times we've been through. Our fathers went down to Egypt and we dwelt with them a long time and they afflicted us and so on. They knew the situation. You know, when Israel was wandering through the wilderness for 38 and a half years after they initially forgot, refused to go in, it's not as if nobody knew what was going on. They knew that the nation was out there, and they other of the tribes and the peoples felt threatened by them. There's a huge, massive group of maybe 2.5 million people, and they all were concerned about where they were. These people were headed. But anyway, the people of Edom, the king of Edom, he knows who these people are, and Moses appeals to him as family. Verse 17, please let us pass through your country. We will not pass through the fields or the vineyards. We won't drink the water from the wells. We'll just stay on the highway. All we want to do is march down Interstate 79. That's all we're going to do. We're not going to take any exit. We're not going to stop any place along the way. We're just going to walk through your territory. The king of Edom said to him, verse 18, you will not pass through my land, lest I come out and attack you with the sword. This is the latent hostility between the people of Edom and the people of Israel 40 years after Israel came out of Egypt, and probably more like 300 years since Esau and Jacob had their falling out. Your brother Israel gets no slack from Edom. There also were Canaanite tribes in the region that they had to deal with. Chapter 21, verse 1, the king of Arad, the Canaanite, who dwelt in the south, heard that Israel was coming on the road to Etherim. So they knew, they were charting, they were watching the people of Israel as they progressed through the area. And he, Arad, fought against Israel, and he took some of them prisoner. He actually won some battles against the people of Israel. So Israel made a vow. He said, if you will deliver this people into our hand, I will utterly destroy their cities. They got kind of peeved at the way that they were treated. And they were willing to take whatever measure was necessary to for their own protection. So God delivered them, and it says that they utterly destroyed them and their cities. As you read through here and even into the book of Joshua as well, you see that these cities knew when a neighboring city had been destroyed by the people of Israel. Again, the word was out. People knew what was happening. And that caused even greater fear and more of a defensive posture by those people in the region. Drop down to verse 21. Chapter 21, verse 21. Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites, saying, let me pass through your land. Same story. But Sihon, it says in verse 23, would not allow Israel to pass through. So there was a battle, and Israel won that battle as well. This contention between the Canaanites and the various descendants of Abraham's family was alive and well. The contention, the bitterness, the hostility, the defensiveness, and the war between these peoples was just getting underway. Chapter 22 begins a story you're familiar with, I know. Israel has been on their way to where they're going to cross over the Jordan into Canaan. They've been kind of skirting around the nation of the land of Moab. But now they have to go through Moab in order to get to their destination. So chapter 22 tells the story of Balak, the king of the Moabites, who tried to hire Balaam to pronounce a curse on the people of Israel. So the Moabites are trying a little different tack. They're not going to try to take them on and battle with them and fight them. They've seen that that didn't work out for others. So now they're just going to get the God of Israel to curse the people of Israel. But it's just the point being that it's, again, it's Moab, descendants of Lot, the family of Abraham, trying to harm, prevent, and hold back the nation of Israel. Israel was sent into the land with the intent or the purpose of destroying the Canaanite tribes that were there. The Canaanites were the ones who inhabited the land of Canaan. And God warned them that they needed to completely destroy those people. Chapter 33, verse 50. Chapter 33, verse 50. The Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, and he said, "Speak to the children of Israel. When you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you, destroy all their engraved stones, destroy all their molded images, demolish all their high places. You shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land and dwell in it, for I have given you the land to possess." They're to drive out all the inhabitants of that land. These would be then Canaanite tribes who were well entrenched in that region. Israel did so, sort of. Read through the book of Joshua. They managed to destroy many of the cities, and they took their cities that God had given to them. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 10. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 10. It sounds... this kind of shows us what God did by allowing the Canaanites to inhabit the land first. Deuteronomy 6, verse 10. "So it shall be when the Lord your God brings you into the land of which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you large and beautiful cities which you did not build, houses full of good things which you did not fill, hewn out wells which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant. When you have eaten and are full, then don't forget the God who provided this for you." But the point that for now is that God had allowed these cities to grow up and these people to inhabit the land, so that Israel would move into a furnished home. It was all there for them. It was all planted. It was all ready. It was all ready for them to take. God had prepared the way for them. God wanted the people of Israel to completely eradicate the Canaanites so that the Israelites would not be drawn into and seduced by the beliefs and the lifestyle, the kind of people that the Canaanites were. As we conclude here now, let's look at 25 years ahead of the time when Israel came into Canaan. Skip ahead 25 years to the end of the book of Joshua. Joshua chapter 21. This book of Joshua summarizes the battles the struggles, the fight of the people of Israel to secure the land of Canaan and to make it their nation. They divided the land between the tribes, and they settled in to make it this their nation, their land. And God intended that all of the vestiges of the Canaanite civilization would be destroyed. Joshua 23, verse 9. Joshua 23 says, "The Lord has driven out from before you great and strong nations. But as for you, no one has been able to stand against you to this day. One of you will chase 1,000. For the Lord your God is he who fights for you as he promised you. Therefore," and here's his urging to the people of Israel, "take careful heed to yourselves that you love the Lord your God." God was giving them this land, these bounties, these blessings, this wealth. But he reminds them to stay focused on him and to realize that he is the one who has provided this for them. Love the Lord your God, or else, if indeed you do go back and cling to the remnant of those nations, those that remain among you, and make marriages with them and go into them, and they to you, know for certain that the Lord will no longer drive out these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps to you, and scourges on your sides, thorns in your eyes, until you perish from the good land which the Lord has given to you. Because Israel did not fully remove the Canaanites from that land, it came back against them. And we know that they did wind up being seduced into the ways of the Canaanites. They did begin to worship the pagan gods. They did begin to adopt the lifestyle of the Canaanites rather than destroying them. The promise that God had made to them was one that was only limited by their failure to follow God's instruction. God was perfectly faithful in all that he did. None of what God promised failed in any way, but the people failed. Chapter 21, verse 43. Chapter 21, verse 43. "The Lord gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it and dwelt in it. The Lord gave them rest all around, according to all that he had sworn to their fathers. Not a man of their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. Not a word failed of any good thing which the Lord had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass." God's promise to his faithful servant Abraham was to provide this land for Abraham's descendants. His family, the family of Abraham through Isaac, had grown into tribes, which each of which would eventually become a nation. They laid claim to the land of their inheritance. But the Canaanites were already there. The other descendants of Abraham were in the region as well. And they laid claim to the same territory as Israel. So the claim to and the fight for the land of Canaan had just begun. And it continues to this day. We'll pick it up there next time.